extent of what Alaska would have taxed that income if the income had been in the state. In other words, if a state of California taxes that income at higher rates than we have, we won't allow the full credit. We'll allow credit only up to our own rates, as though that income had been earned in state. Non-residents are treated a little bit differently under this bill than they were treated under the former income tax Alaska had, and differently from the way they are treated in almost every other state. Non-residents, we don't tax on the basis of overall everywhere income, on the basis of citizenship. We tax only, and constitutionally may tax only, the income that they earn within our jurisdiction. In the past, we have simply had a non-resident file a return that shows how much income they earned in the state and applied our tax rates to that income. That has the result, if the non-resident has income from another jurisdiction as well as from Alaska, it has the result of allowing the non-resident to put all of his Alaska taxable income in the bottom brackets. And so, for example, if we had a non-resident that earned $25,000 in Alaska and earned $100,000 overall in the year, the old law would have taxed that $25,000 at the lowest brackets in on our Alaska statute, so that it would have been as though he would be treated exactly as an Alaskan who only earned $25,000 overall. This law, on page 2 of the bill, subsection K, requires a non-resident to calculate the tax on all of his income everywhere, and then determine a fraction of that tax that is due in the state. And the fraction of the tax is calculated by comparing his adjusted gross income in Alaska with his adjusted gross income everywhere. This provision has the effect of spreading the non-resident's income throughout the tax bracket, so that a person who earns $100,000 overall is treated, even though only part of that was earned in Alaska, is treated in the same way as an Alaskan who earns $100,000, in that his income will reach the highest brackets that we have and the highest effective tax rate. This is a provision that Oregon used for a couple of years and repealed for political pressure. They also were, I talked to the Attorney General's office down there, there were threats of litigation, but they were never sued. And no other state does this. It seems to be perfectly constitutional, and in fact, it seems to rectify an inequity that most states use vis-a-vis non-residents. I feel quite comfortable with the validity of the approach, but it is unique.
My additional question would run to the applicability of deductions for local government tax credits. Is there any reason we couldn't provide a deduction to everyone who pays the Alaska income tax, resident and non-resident, for any expenses and taxes they paid to local governments in the state of Alaska, local sales taxes, local property taxes, business licenses, et cetera?
Opinion.
I think there's two parts of that. One is the legal side of it, and I'd like Deborah to comment on that. The other side of it, though, is there any reason not to do it from assuming that it's legally possible, I think it is, but that not to do it from a revenue standpoint or policy standpoint. Of course, it does reduce the amount of the tax base. That's what it does. And would then transfer and have an effect transferring the tax base from the state to the local government or whatever, wherever the government expenditure applied, maybe against the government itself. I think there are a lot of policy questions involved in that. I don't leave the legal side out of it. I just touch on two or three of them. One of them is the extent that the tax base is transferred to the local government. You might end up with a situation analogous to the present state property tax on oil and gas production, transportation, and exploration property, where on a tax base in the range of $18 billion, the state only has revenues from about 30% of that tax base, although it's a state tax base. The rest goes to local government. What that means is instead of getting something like $350 or $60 million, the state gets about $90 million a year out of that. So it could erode the tax base, and if you put those things in there, it would either require constant legislative review to protect the tax base or to make sure that the new effects are warranted, or it could be, and that's one issue, and another issue that would simply be that those Alaskans who might be paying full tilt on the taxes because they don't have those deductions may or may not be getting comparable benefits from the state equal to what the people in the local government area are receiving. Those are questions for the legislature to consider. In the consideration of this bill and how to draft it, we wanted to keep it as clean as we could so that what came to the legislature unencumbered or unfettered by a whole bunch of those little policy decisions. We've had the people from the who like to sell municipal bonds come in and yell at us because they thought we should have put that in the bill. And there's a lot of, you know, there's no child care credits in the bill. There's lots of things you could put in there. But those are all policy decisions the legislature could be looking at. We tried to keep it as clean as we could. Deborah?
As far as, if I understand your question, is it was first whether we are required to give a tax credit for other taxes paid, and maybe that wasn't, it certainly were not. I do believe that if we did allow a tax credit for municipal taxes and we use this method of taxing non-residents so that we look at their overall income everywhere, we probably have to account for local taxes paid outside of the state by a non-resident as well as, was that your question, whether we could just deduct Alaska taxes and not taxes?
Yeah, that was my question. So your testimony would be in the other system that the other states use, we could discriminate between our own state taxes and not our own Alaska local taxes and non-Alaska local taxes.
It would seem to me that suppose you had part of your resident who earned $75,000 out of the state and $25,000 in the state. If all you looked at was that $25,000 that he earned in the state, then it might be possible, certainly, to limit the deductions to the $25,000. Deductions to taxes that were actually paid in the state. If you're going to look at the entire $100,000 that he earned, then it seems to me that you probably have to make an accommodation for similar taxes paid in conjunction with that income. I think that you probably, I hesitate to give you a final legal answer, but I think those are the considerations.
You're saying if we allow that for Alaskans, we probably have to extend the same sort of benefits to non-residents.
Right.
I kind of like to look at the bottom line, and this one here I didn't have in my packet. I assume when you say 2,900 jobs lost, this is the one that said, what are the economic effects? That means that 2,900 jobs are lost because the permanent fund money that had previously flowed into the economy is now going directly to the state treasury.
No, sir. Those charts don't have anything to do, at least not directly, with the permanent fund dividend.
Well,
they compare...
Right, I know that, but you're still people, whether it's permanent fund dividend or dollars for McDonald's, they're still going to have to pay that money to the state government. So that's coming out of the economy into state government, not correct?
And going from state government back into the economy. Right.
Via down here, though. Right?
You bet.
Yeah, it's not the direct flow. Like, I get my $500 and I spend it. I go get a stereo, and that's right into the economy. Those figures were one of the strong things that support the permanent fund dividend. What I see here is just shifting it from one pocket to the other, you know? And what my concern is, how much has it cost us to remove that many dollars out of the economy by going straight into the economy?
In terms of jobs?
Yeah.
Well, as the number indicates there, maybe I'm missing your question, Representative Boucher, but my very rough estimate is that if the income tax affects people as the Institute of Social Economic Research suggested that it would in their paper last year, the economy would be likely to lose about 2,900 jobs.
Okay.
As a consequence.
What 2,900 jobs would these be?
About 1,000 of them, a little over 1,000 of them, are they're all indirect in effects, and then the support sector effects. So generally, the fact that you don't have the money in the pocket means you don't buy the stereo, means you don't go to the store, means they lay off somebody at some point. Now, the important point to and I want to emphasize this, is that the alternative here is not, is
that's 6,700.
That's right.
Now, how do you arrive at that 6,700 jobs?
I'll give you the calculation, but about 2,000 of those jobs are state employees who are cut. And the others, 4,700 of them, are support sector jobs.
Okay, in other words, what you're basically talking about, if you do not implement this, then you would have to implement cuts that would result in 6,700 jobs being lost.
And clearly there are other alternatives that don't cut jobs, but they also have costs. And if those are the two alternatives, if you do, as a consequence of not passing an income tax, reduce spending, then that's the reduction in jobs. I'm not saying that that's the only other possibility, but it's clear to me that in the end, in 1989, FY89, when you come up upon the crunch, you're probably going to end up having to cut even more than that. But your analysis is correct, Representative Boucher. I don't want to belabor that point. I think you understand the calculations as I made them. I want to emphasize that I think we need a more rigorous analysis of these trade-offs.
That's what I'd like to see.
We are hopeful to provide that to you in the next few weeks.
Because this is a pretty startling figure. You know, you go through the numbers, and then you say, well, this is your choice, either 2,900 jobs or 6,700 jobs. And I'd really like to know how we arrive at those of your pies out here. Mm-hmm. The others I can add, subtract, and divide, but you got me lost with this.
I think that's a good question, and I'll provide you personally with the calculations I made. I think, though, it's important to realize that the real numbers are going to be provided by people who've done a more rigorous analysis than I have.
Okay, fine.
Just as a follow-up, I think the next time this committee meets on these bills, we will have some additional economists who have perspectives somewhat similar, perhaps somewhat different, in terms of job loss. It's obviously very important in terms of analyzing the impact of these bills on our economy. Okay, Lyman, then Kurt, then Terry, then Fran. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I guess my concern again goes back to taxing people fair and equitable. And I'm glad you gave us the chart of where's the income. And I guess my concern, the legislature, I guess, probably won't get accused of protecting one group or another group or protecting ourselves because, you know, the majority of us fall into a category that isn't going to be affected by the percentages. But, you know, the people that are proposing this have to come up with something that's fair and equitable. And we have the percentage of 3.2 and 5.2. I think that my personal feelings or my personal observations are that the tax schedule benefits the rich. And when you look at the federal tax structure, it has the graduate. You say this is graduated, but it's only graduated with two steps. And I would say that maybe there is a chance for an additional income and be fair and equitable at the same time. When you look at the people that make over $100,000 a year, that's 16% of the income group. But they are being taxed at the same rate as people way down here at the $50,000. Range. So from just appearances, it seems as though the system that is proposed here is slanted toward the rich.
These are value judgments, and I think there are some people probably on the who've worked on this in the administration who might agree with you and some who might disagree with you. I will say that the decisions on the tax progressiveness, the slope, and the number of brackets, were made in a period in which we had a great deal of work to do. And I think that I'm hopeful that the legislature will look at the kinds of concerns you have and give a more considered review of those tax brackets and rates, because I don't think you're going to find that the administration is going to be uncooperative in looking or doing analysis that you might want done on the revenue effects of different proposals. I think you make some good points, sir.
Representative Bernard.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Not anything that's earth-shaking here, but if we take the hypothetical situation, hypothetical at this time, is that if we adopted this income tax, and then we listen to the commissioner's points that he made out on a few of these that and bring in some of the concerns that Lyman Hoffman brought in, is that paying a tax makes us a more responsible person, or makes us more responsible to our government and more involved in the process. And I guess therefore we would assume somewhere down there that it could be good good policy. Then we go a little further down the line and we fill out our form and we get down to line 23 where I'm going to be. I can see, I don't like the way that smiley face is looking. It's reflecting an attitude, and we say attitude is 80% of the difference. You know, and I'm supposed to be doing something good, and I look at this little guy here, and he says, "Hey, are you stupid or what?" So at one point, no further questions.
I think Commissioner Long wants to say something.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, first of all, there actually was considerable debate over the smiley face. We can go into that at some point. But if I said that paying taxes makes people more responsible, then I misspoke myself. I don't believe that. I believe that paying taxes makes people hold the government more accountable and responsible. That's what I believe. And that's what I would hope would be one of the benefits of having this sort of revenue measure on the books. I think it makes the government more responsible when the government has to justify the expenditures to the people, because at least part of that money is coming out of people's pockets. I think people are plenty responsible, but I don't think governments always are.
Yeah, thank you, Representative. For the main question, I think that is a very legitimate point that the commissioner had brought out. It's been spoken about when we were together talking about the repeal of taxation in the first place, what makes people accountable. And as Mr. Erickson said, you know, our country for 140 years had no taxation. And I think in those days, people were very responsible. And the government was accountable. So it goes both ways. Today, if it's accountable, is the question. The main thing I'd like to know as a need to follow up scenarios that have been presented to the Tax Committee as well as the State Affairs Committee as to the true value of the out-of-state non-residents paying tax. And I'm afraid from some of the talks that I've heard and people call me up about that, people may be misconceiving how much tax will be generated from the non-state workers, out-of-state workers. For instance, in the Commission during the summer, there was one scenario at a $300 million level, we could get in perhaps $17 million. Now, Mr. Erickson mentioned that perhaps at $250 million, we can get 10%, $25 million from out-of-state workers. And I'd really like to get a better handle on that, because it's a rationalization that's being used which doesn't necessarily follow through. If I may elaborate, the Department of Labor gave us some very good statistics last week on the number of out-of-state workers, 277,000, yet 44,000 were fishing people, low-paying jobs, 20,000 were tourist-related industry employees, low-paying jobs. Would they really be paying that much in tax? Can we zero in better before we use that as a major rationalization?
Representative Martin, I think your question is right on point. We believe that these numbers need to be looked at a little more carefully. We can tell you some facts, though. One is that in 1976, non-residents paid 16% of the income tax. In 1977, they paid, if I recall correctly, 11%. 1970, or something close to that. By 1979, in any event, the percentage had fallen to about 10.6%, 10.4%. So we know that we have a history of collecting about that much. We also know that this tax should attribute higher amounts of income tax to Alaska than the old tax did, because every non-resident got the benefit of the fiction that they were entitled to those low brackets, which this tax will not do if it's adopted in its current form. But the Department of Labor is looking at this particular instance, and the gentlemen who will be working on it, that are working on it, are here today and listening to your testimony. I'm sure they're going to try to respond as best they can. And the Department of Revenue is also looking at this as well. And we have some different estimates ourselves that we think this is a real important point, and we think it demands a more rigorous analysis than we've given it so far. So we agree with you.
I might just indicate at the beginning of the session, I got a figure of 25% from the Department of Revenue, that the estimate would be approximately 25% of the revenues raised would come from non-residents. And I was curious if perhaps that was because we used to have more non-residents working than we do today or what, but I think a clarification would be.
I suspect the 25% may reflect not taxes collected, but something else. That's not consistent with the numbers that the Department of Revenue has developed so far.
At any rate, it's something we'd like to clarify.
Yeah.
I've got two quick questions, and then we'll call it a day. First of all, one is the Department of Revenue folks, and it relates to the 41 other states that have state income taxes. According to materials which you shared with us today, the rates in those other states appear to be higher than what you are proposing for the state of Alaska's income tax. But I imagine a number of those states, because of their additional deductions and other factors, may have a real rate which is lower than Alaska's. And if you have additional information associated with how Alaska's income tax would stack up against those 41 other states' income tax, that would be useful as well, in terms of a real rate as opposed to just the percentage rate.
Madam Chairman, the state with the income tax that weighs the heaviest on its citizens' personal income is Oregon. They collect about 4% of their citizens' personal income in tax. Tax being proposed here will collect roughly, in 1988, about 2.8%. About 2.8%. So we're well below the top. I calculated the number of states with income taxes that would be collecting more of Alaska's personal income, and the number was 14. So Alaska's the 14th highest, I guess you might say, from the 14th from the top of those states that have income taxes. But in fact, it's right down well below the highest in terms of its burden on the individual's personal income.
Yes. Thank you. The second question relates to the bill that we did not get to talk about today, which is the earnings reserve bill. To a certain extent, you did address it in your earlier part of the presentation that looked at to what extent we will be relying on liquid reserves to just get through FY87 and FY88. I would just request that the next time we meet on these bills, you might be prepared to discuss with the committee what the administration's position is with regard to the appropriate use of the earnings of the fund beyond filling this quote-unquote temporary revenue gap, whether you will be proposing something that gives some predictability associated with using the earnings, something along the lines of former Representative Oral Freeman's approach of 40-40-20, so that there is, again, some predictability of how much of the earnings will be used, or whether you will recommend that we continue to simply view those as reserves as needed to fill the gap, quote-unquote, whenever we may need to do so. I guess it would be helpful for us to know the administration's intent with regard to the permanent fund earnings over time, not just in FY87 and 88. Okay, if there aren't any other committee questions at this point in time, I'd just like to thank you all. It's been an excellent briefing. Thank you for the time and energy that went into it, and we will be back with you again probably in about a week to follow up. Thanks again. State Affairs Committee is adjourned.
Thank you for a very well-presented meeting, Madam Chair.
Thank you for all of your good questions and for all of your good intentions. Hey,